Jen, I don't think, and I'm editing this today, so I'll decide, and I want to restate this, which is you're going on another podcast to debate people. I guess having vanquished me on the January 6th indictments, you are now moving on to a bigger, more reputable battlefield. You are going to go debate Michael Tracy on the Useful Idiots podcast.
Yeah, I have that right after this podcast. And I'm excited. I really respect Michael Tracy. He was one of the people that was the loudest in pointing out that Russiagate had nothing behind it. And so this is someone that I think is rational, isn't tribal in any way. And so I'm excited for a conversation with someone that I think it's going to be about the issue. You know, it's, I wouldn't want to debate this with someone who is just trying to be pro Trump and is just trying to, like, yeah, you know, tell me the team red line. I don't think that's what this is. I was looking at his Twitter feed today, and I think he has genuine concerns about, especially the free speech aspect to it. And yeah, so I'm excited to have a conversation with someone who I think is genuine.
Jen, I think you're the only person I lock antlers with in political media on a right. Well, because I'm such a
pussy.
I'm pussy. Exactly. I am a besuited Mr. Rogers character, and so like the way my brain works is to try to go like, okay, we've got a disagreement. Let's figure out where we overlap first, and then let's go to the disagreement bit. But there's going to be a guy you're gonna love him, Jen. It's an episode that I'm gonna recommend you listen to on my show. Guy Standing, who I won't get into it now because I'll eventually pitch it, but like, probably, like, I would describe him as a full-blown commie, and we agreed on like 80% of the stuff. Like, we walked away and we were like, we actually agree on most things, but I should have like fought him. But my instincts are to be like, okay, where do we agree? How did you get there? I love and respect you enough that I feel comfortable going, no, you're goddamn wrong, and then slapping Justin because I can't hit a girl, so I hit him through proxy.
Exactly.
That's fair.
Exactly.
That's fair. But I think that's a smart thing to do, is to find your agreements first. And one of the things that I know about Michael Tracy is I agree with him on far more than I disagree. So we are going to have that, like, okay, so here's the basics of, like, this is right and this is wrong. And when it comes to the 1-6 stuff, I can understand being worried about Trump being unfairly prosecuted, because the first two indictments, like the first one about campaign finance violations, get the fuck out of here. We have a system based on bribery. And then the second one.
Well, and Michael Cohen is your key witness, which is like, can you? Yeah.
There are problems with that one. And then, you know, the second one, classified documents, like, yeah, he did it. But that we have an overclassification problem in this country, and it sounds like a lot of people walk out the door with classified documents, but this one is different. But I can understand looking at that history, looking at the impeachments that have happened, and go, they've been coming for Trump for a long time, and I am skeptical. I get that. And so, I think that's going to be the place where we agree, and then we'll disagree on, you know, what the crime is. But
could you guys help me on this if you know the answer to this?
Yeah.
I feel like when it comes to judicial things, for a comedian who's never been to law school, I'm pretty good on constitutional law. Mm. I know amendments and I read that. I don't know criminal law. I have no background. I have no reading in criminal law. I do not know it. So like what I'm reading now is that in order to convict Trump on conspiracy, he has to be proven for intent. Which I would say would be
corrupt
a very difficult
intent.
Thing.
Corrupt if intent is the term of art. Yeah.
So the first two of the four charges require proving that he had intent.
No, only
corrupt
one.
Corrupt intent.
There's one that's conspiracy. Two that's basically obstructing the ceremony, and then the third is depriving people the right to vote and have their vote be counted. It's the second half that matters. And what's fascinating about this particular indictment is the way they did it. They told that one story, and all four charges are related to that one story. So even if you can't quite get them on the conspiracy, what they did pretty clearly disrupted the ceremony. I mean, they were trying to use fake documents to cause chaos, and then depriving people of the right to have their vote be counted. If their plan had succeeded, they either were going to have all of the voters of 7 states not have their vote counted, or all of the voters in the United States minus those that serve in the House of Representatives. So I think that's what's kind of genius about this indictment, the way they did it, where they said this is the overall story and there were 4 crimes in it. So even if they can't quite prove intent, although having watched the January 6th committee, there was plenty of evidence, in my opinion, that Trump knew he lost. But even if they struggle with that, there's still those other counts. So we'll see what happens.
I think the fraud one's the strongest one. The civil rights one still strikes me as kind of fishy. And by that, I mean there doesn't seem to be a limiting principle on it. So like I think during the mailbag, we might get into some electoral reform stuff. So there are lots of things that are currently legally done in the United States, very above board done, that I would say are specifically designed to make votes not count, like gerrymandering, things like that.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't go through the courts on that and say that they are themselves illegal. And so I don't think that one's particularly strong. But I do think the fraud one is, because of what we discussed last week with having fake electors come in.
There's a New York Times report today by Maggie Haberman and two other less famous co-authors, and they have procured a memo that was not surfaced by the January 6th committee that is referenced in the indictment. And that is by John Cheesebro.
Cheesebro.
Who, by the way, is from Wisconsin. Tell me we're not living in a simulation when Kenneth Cheesebro is from Wisconsin. And so it is being cited. It is very heavily cited in the indictment as early proof. This is from, I believe, November 14th, that the beginning of this plan with alternate or fake electors, spice to taste, were pitched within the Trump orbit. And I don't know. I'm not to the point where I'm going to be fully rooting for Michael Tracy in your debate, but I am yes, excited to see you guys go back and forth. No, I'm rooting for you because I want you to really, what I want is for you to be workshopping what we're not wrong plugs you're going to get in to this exactly. appearance. That's Jim, all I really care about. Jim, I don't care if you get humiliated or not. I just want people to know that this is a podcast that they should listen to.
Thanks, Justin.
100%. Please mention this show. My goal is my goal with every one of these programs, which is that we make money and Jen cries. And if that happens to you during the debate, it's a good day.
And this is why Heaton and I don't have friends. From Austin, Texas, I'm Justin Robert Young from Mexico City, Mexico.
I am Jennifer Briney.
And from Edinburgh, Scotland,
I'm Andrew Heaton.
And we're not wrong. On this edition of the program, we're going to be talking about polls. What are they good for? Absolutely nothing. We asked 100 respondents and then weighted them according to statistical average.
And they all as well as
a naval exercise by China and Russia, and whether or not that has been egged on by the invasion of Ukraine, all that, and your emails. Let's get right into it. After our discussion of the January 6th indictment, Jen and I were having a conversation. Or no, I think you tagged me in a Instagram story, Jen.
Sounds like something I would do.
wherein somebody put up a column from the Washington Examiner talking about how Donald Trump was a bane to the party and needed to be abandoned. Mm. The tweet that was then screen grabbed and put on Instagram had then a parenthetical that I thought told the whole story, which is the Washington Examiner, parenthetical, a conservative newspaper. Which, if you have to explain that the Washington Examiner is a conservative newspaper, it tells me all about who you're talking to, because you have obviously never heard of the Washington Examiner before. So I joked over Instagram with Jen about that parenthetical, and I then said that polls would be a better way to tell how Republicans are responding to this indictment, to follow along with Jen's thought that this would erode support for Trump now that this information is out in the open.
I think the point that I was making in that story was that Republicans are turning on Trump.
Exactly. Yeah. That was my point. Yes, that was your point. I thought that was funny because, to quote the Washington Examiner, which has been a home for never Trump voices in the past, would not be particularly man bites dog to me. But then again, I don't.
Is the Washington Examiner a never Trump place? Because I feel like that's so. Pretty consistently the bulwark and the Dispatch. But well,
It is not without never Trump voices.
There are some voices that have remained there.
No, I mean, like it's an establishment. It was an establishment place. I mean, like it's not Breitbart. It's not the Gateway Pundit. Like it's not places that are fully intellectually captured.
But the tweet was written by Scott Galloway, who speaks to a much broader audience. And so he was just kind of pointing out the Examiner is not MSNBC. You know, it's something that does have its finger on the Republican pulse. And the point I was making is that there are Republican pulses that are saying we're not into Trump. So.
Yes, as there have been since 2015.
I think it's increasing, but. Okay.
And I suggested that a way to track that increase would be polling, to which Jen told me that polls are bullshit. So since it's August and there's no fucking news to talk about, I figured we'd talk about polls. So according to a 2018 Hill-Harris-X poll, the majority of registered voters, 52%, are indeed doubtful of surveys that they hear about in the news media. 29% of respondents said that they don't believe most polls or trust a few, while 19% said they almost never believe that polls are accurate. And while the majority are mistrustful of polls, 15% of respondents said they almost always believed polls that they hear about in the press. 33% said they believed most polls, but not all of them. And so, with that bukkake of numbers, we move into our conversation. Jen, why don't you believe in polls?
They're just, so I did take statistics in college, and I just know how easy it is to ask questions a certain way to get the responses that you're going for. I also was alive and an adult during 2016 when all these goddamn polls told us that Hillary had it in the bag, and guess who didn't win the presidency? So I just think that they're easily tainted. They've proven themselves to be wrong. And I think what annoys me the most about them is that people treat them as news. And so for the next, I mean, it's already started, but there are so many people that just report breathlessly on what we think via these polls. I don't think that they're useful. And because of 2016, I no longer really believe they're all that accurate. So there you go.
I'll add a pylon, Jen. I hate it when people treat polls as gospel. So like I just read an Economist article. Next week, I've got a nuclear engineer coming on the program to talk about nuclear power. And I was reading an Economist article and it said 45% of Democrats now favor nuclear power, whereas 55% of Republicans favor it. And I'm like, no, you didn't go to every single Republican and Democrat throughout the United States to get their opinion on this. 45% of those polled, or you could say polling indicates that. But it tends to be what the bit that irritates me. I do find them useful. I don't think that they're complete garbage. I think that they are useful as a metric within a broader ecosystem. But what I do have a problem with is if the poll benefits whatever I'm pushing, it's fucking gospel.
Yes.
It is the gospel of John at the polls. But if I don't agree with it, well, the polls are never right anyway. And so I think that they are useful in that they can be maybe directionally accurate oftentimes, but it's almost like you're just looking at a bunch of anecdotal data, right? So like if you talk to one guy and one guy says, I don't like Donald Trump very much, you're like, well, that's just one guy. That's not it. It is somewhat useful. Like if I'm here in Scotland, I talk to people. There's no way that I'm going to be able to get a full view of everybody in Scotland based on talking to people. But I do get an ability to kind of get into the mindset by speaking to a limited amount of people. I think polls are that only more broad. They are better than that, but they still have inaccuracies and they're not gospel. So I tend to view them. I stole a page from Justin Robert Young back when we were in New Hampshire, where you can also look at like how many people are showing up to rallies, how many yards are in signs are in yards, things like that. So like you could have multiple different things to try and put your finger in the wind, and polls are one of them, but they're not gospel.
So let me do the anti-poll rant first, and then I will defend them. The anti-poll rant is that there has been a degradation in the signal for polling for the past 30 years, and it has been a combined effect of two different things. Number one, there are less people and institutions that pay for polls and pay for polls that take longer and therefore would be more accurate because you are relying less on sampling than actually finding the demographics that you would need to find to hit the representative metrics for wherever you are trying to talk to. So if you are polling for Iowa, for example, which we will see a lot of polls between now and January or February when that caucus happens, you need to find a representative sample of that state for it to be accurate. And so if you are only paying a polling firm for, let's say, 3 days to do that, and you only get X amount of people to respond to it, then you have to sample for the difference, which means you have to count some people less and some people more than you would otherwise. That's bad. It means that there is a degradation of that specific kind of information. The other side of it is telephones. Back in the day, you could just call somebody's house and they would pick it up. They were socialized to pick it up because that was where information came from, be it a solicitor or your grandma or a sick friend that you haven't heard from in 30 years. That was the mystery of picking up the phone. And people were more likely to sit on the phone for 30 minutes to take the kind of poll that they need to do. In our cell phone era, people don't want to do that. Spam technology is a lot better. We filter out all but exactly. I mean, I have an app on my phone now that overscreens because the spam calls were getting so bad on my cell phone that now when I actually have a random person that I want to call me, it gets caught up in the spam filter. So there's less of an ability to reach people. And I do think that that has had a material degradation of polls in general. And I don't think that they're gospel, but they are useful. They are as useful as counting yard signs. They are as useful as doing a lot of these other colloquial things of just getting a general sense of momentum, a general sense of where things are. Because ultimately, polls are trying to predict something that is impossible, which is finding out what the outcome is going to be on a certain day. The best way that I've ever heard polls talked about are that they are a snapshot of if the election were right now. So, for example, these political horse race polls that we are going to see a lot of throughout the primaries and the general election. It is a snapshot of what Michigan thinks today. Is today the election? No. So is it going to be the same as what happens when election day rolls around? Probably not, because it's not measuring for that. It's measuring for right now. And to use your 2016 example, Jen, there was a meaningful pushback in the polls to Trump as we got closer to election day. Now, was that covered the way that we would probably cover it now? No, it wasn't. It was looked at as non-statistically relevant noise because I'm with her and so are you.
The Clinton campaign was basically approaching it epistemologically the way a doomsday cult would. Of just no, 100% anything that doesn't fit the bill is absolutely not a thing.
And by the way, they were, and I believe this is in the book Shattered about Hillary Clinton's campaign and that 2016 campaign in general, which I thought is excellent. It's one of my favorite campaign books that I've read about that election. The Clinton campaign was internally seeing poll numbers that were telling them that things were fucked in Michigan. And they would not go there because they thought it would be admitting defeat to go to Michigan, and people would smell blood in the water, and they would rather pretend that everything was fine because they were going to win any. And besides, they didn't even need Michigan. It was going to be fine. Everything's cool. Nothing's fucked here, dude. And then guess what? It was. But they knew that there were cracks in the foundation. They decided not to do it, and the way that they knew it was polling.
Which is fine, but I mean, that's one state. And, you know, she also didn't go to Wisconsin or, you know, Pennsylvania. Like there were other states that the polls seemed to be saying that she was a shoo-in for. And now I'm kind of feeling the same vibe, except this time they don't want to screw up in the same way. So now they're telling us that Trump is a shoo-in. I just, And I think you're... I think
who's they? Who is they?
So, and that's exactly it. I think one of the problems that I'm having with polls is not necessarily the polls themselves, but the way that people speak about polls in the media, including podcasts. They are given way too much importance, way too much airtime. And I think it's actually detrimental because instead of discussing the candidates' policies and what they say they're going to do and what they're running on, we're reporting on polls instead of the important stuff, instead of this is how this person's election is going to affect your day-to-day life. And so I think polls just in general have become detrimental to the media landscape. And that's my biggest problem with them.
Can we point out real quick that the group that was really caught with its pants down in 2016 was political consultants, and they seem to be doing fine? Like, that was, I was kind of, the one thing I was excited about the day after 2016 was we're finally going to get rid of this parasite class. Like, everybody's seen that they're useless, that Trump didn't use them at all. Trump, they would like come out and be like, hey, we think you should do this thing. And he'd go, no, I'm going to say we're going to hang Rosie O'Donnell from a tree. It'll be funny. And he would just absolutely go in a different direction. And Hillary Clinton had armies of them, entire platoons of them. And they were useless. And they're like, they're real, like, they're snake oil salesmen. And they're doing fine. I don't think that industry has taken the slightest hit whatsoever.
You know, I was thinking about that today because I'm looking to get back out on the campaign trail and I'm watching a bunch of people talking in all these small rooms in New Hampshire and Iowa and stuff like that. And the money that is coming in for these primaries has never been bigger. We are talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. And I know bands that are on tour that go on tour for 11 cents and have better production value than these candidates do with hundreds of millions of dollars behind them. The best they can do is a very rudimentary backdrop in some bingo hall somewhere that the mics barely work. They can barely stage anybody. Like, you should be able to shoot a music video for the amount of money that you are doing per stop. And this doesn't go there because it goes to the consultants.
Yeah, they have standing between two big rigs with no bathrooms or cookies.
That was us in Nevada.
Yeah, I was so mad.
I don't
want
to reveal too much. I'm not supposed to say this. I'm probably going to get in trouble for this, but because audience, I love you, I'm going to be honest and tell you what the elites don't want you to know.
Yeah.
When you're running a campaign, you want to intentionally have a room that's too small. And you want to look a little disheveled because what you want to communicate is that you didn't even want to be here, but you felt called by your duty to the American people because you can't take it anymore. And you're going to come up there with your sleeves rolled up and it's going to be in this mid-shift thing because we're the little guy fighting the big guy. And there's standing room only because we intentionally picked a room that could only fit 40 people for this. So I think the optics there, Justin, are intentional. If you make it too whiz bang, then you're the big guy. You don't want to be the big guy. You want to be the little guy.
Yeah, God,
who's
no,
fighting for the little guy.
No, you certainly wouldn't want it to feel like a concert with the Village People playing. Oh, wait, no, that's the most successful politician of the last 7 years. Oh, yeah, that's what that guy does. No, you should do a bigger thing. Like, this is, again, this is the consulting class brainworms of, there's a reason why we can only have one tractor trailer that we put up the same thing over and over and over again, or that we just roll our bus, like, fuck it, roll the bus behind it, do it outside. We don't even need a tent. We don't need any kind of preparation. Who needs that shit? Well, apparently the people that actually are succeeding are putting a little bit more time and effort into making this a pleasurable, if not, dare I say it, gasp fun experience, which every Trump rally that I have covered, the people there are having a ball. Like, if you told them, like, I will either give you tickets to your favorite band or you can go see Donald Trump, I would hesitate. Maybe the next time I do a Trump rally, I'll ask this. I'm sure they would say, I want to be here for Trump. Like, they are
ABBA,
hands trembling, excited,
Trump,
like Swifties at the Eras Tour.
That's awful.
You know what? Point taken. Trump is able to make that fun tailgating carnival environment. I think maybe Scott Adams pointed this out during the 2016 election, that Clinton rallies were kind of like bracing yourself for a funeral. that they were very much like dig in and like we got to do this. Whereas the Trump rallies, like people have wacky hats and they're, you know, eating corn dogs and singing and stuff just seem to be more fun.
One time when I went to a Trump rally in Vegas, the Secret Service took my vape pen.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Nice. Did you get it back?
No. It's federally illegal, so I think it's probably smart that they didn't arrest me. But the Secret Service, because it's legal in Vegas, but the Secret Service just looked at my weed vape and was just like, for real? And I'm like, whoops. Nobody's nerfed.
So I'm going to say another benefit to polls before we get. I'm happy to go off top. By the way, I don't know why I'm not getting hired to write jokes for candidates. Like I've only been one time.
You want to try some out? You want to try some out? All right, Tim Scott.
Off the top of my head.
Yeah, riff some Tim Scott.
I'm just
going to
drop Glenn Youngkin jokes off the top of my head. No, I'm a goddamn professional, Justin. I would sit down and do some cocaine and write those jokes.
I don't know. Larry Ellison's dropping like $100 million on Tim Scott, so now's the time to hit him up for a puncher.
Yeah. The only thing I've ever done, I think I got hired to write jokes for Joe Lieberman roast.
He's back. Like, that's it. He's back. You could write jokes for him with No Labels. Will.
Yes, he went on the No Labels people.
Oh yeah.
Oh boy.
Hey, No Labels, you should reach out to me right fucking now. I'm rooting for you guys. I doubt you have a lot of comedians. Come on. Okay, wait. Back to the polls.
If you went to work for No Labels, Jen would be madder at you than me telling her that I'm rooting for Michael Tracy.
I don't get mad at people for their political statements. You know that.
So, wait, I've got a fun as this is, I have a sobering thing real quick.
Go ahead. Let's bring it on down. Bring it on down.
I am skeptical of feelings, particularly.
Shocker.
Just in general.
Particularly.
Fuck your feelings.
In general. In general, I don't trust them. But beyond that, I'm particularly skeptical of feelings when they're an intuition that confirms what I already think. When it's a confirmation bias or a tribal bias, we're about to go into hyperdrive tribalism time right now, and there's going to be a lot of confirmation bias, what we call motivated reasoning, to arrive at conclusions to be on the right team, my team. I find polls to actually oftentimes be useful to remove some of that bile that we have between red team and blue team. So a very good example of this is gay rights and gay marriage. I think a lot of the time this is we speak about this in our country as the Democrats are the pro-gay marriage party and the Republicans are the homophobe party. When you look at the polls, though, that is not the case. But polling-wise, what's been happening the last 20, 30 years is both parties sucked. And then the Democrats got better and the Republicans are getting better, too, but slower. And you can look at the polling year by year and you can see that the gap is not actually that the Republicans are getting worse. It's just that they're not becoming pro-gay as fast as the Democrats are. But if you were to go back 10 years, you'd find the Republicans are better than the Democrats were 20 years ago. So like in instances like that, I think polling can be very useful because sometimes it's not black and white, good team versus bad team. It's actually like a lag effect. And those are worth noting because if it's a situation like that, like I know a lot of people right now who I think would view the conservatives as being, you know, extremely racist and all these different things. And then we start looking at the polling data of what people actually think and where their preferences and values are and things. It's like, you know, they might end up where you are, but actually we're way better than we were 20, 30 years ago. And again, like, there's this phenomenon where one of the two teams is just trailing the other team. It's not that they're a binary. It's just that there's a lag. And I think polling is useful for being able to indicate that and take some of the bile out of politics.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that there is a gravity to polling in terms of giving a voice to a feeling that people have. So Ron DeSantis' entire campaign is prefaced on the idea that Republicans were into the idea of a Trump alternative. And that was the case until Trump started trashing Ron DeSantis, and then Ron DeSantis announced, and he has not been running a particularly good campaign, and the polls have shown that enthusiasm for him has waned. And that has been reflected in the fact that now that he has replaced his campaign manager, because if you lose 20 points in the polls from when you announce or when you are when the year has begun, then that means somebody's not doing their job right. The rollout wasn't right. The points they're making now wasn't right. You're probably going to see some strategic shift. what I am sympathetic to, Jen, is the idea of how we talk about it, and specifically the political assurity that polling tends to have in an increasingly leveraged, if not biased, media that is speaking to very, very segregated audiences, and oftentimes I think is guilty of trying to tell them what they want to hear. And so what we saw with the Hillary Clinton campaign, for example, in 2016, was a lot of absolutely no sweat. There's no chance. There's no roadmap. Look at these polls. Absolutely, this is a slam dunk. That was not the case. And that was an overconfidence by the interpretations of these polls, where some, and for folks who were listening to like the 538 podcast or reading that site, you did see a material shift in their aggregate, to the point where it got to like 25% chance that Trump was going to win from like 10% 2 weeks before the election. So there had been a swing going the opposite direction in some of those polling. And I think that the healthy way to look at polling, or at least the healthy way that I have looked at polling, is not as a prophecy, but rather just a flicker in the flame. It is a little fraction of a possible future that might change. But right now, that is a flicker of what people think today. You should not take them particularly seriously, but I don't think that discounting them entirely makes us smarter about the realities of our political world, at the very least.
Yeah, and I don't think we have to... I mean, you're right about all of that. I don't disagree with a word of it. And I'm not discounting them entirely, but the over-reliance on them for news content really bothers me. And as you pointed out before, there is a generational thing going on with these polls. So when you talk about they're polling people, I hear they're polling boomers, because boomers are the only people with landlines. And so I do think that we are getting a lot of coverage of what elderly people think. And there are a lot of people that are being left out of the conversation because of the focus on polls, because people in my generation, especially Generation Z, are not getting polled at all. So I just think that with the accuracy going down, I don't think that we should be making decisions on which candidates should stay in the race based on polls. I think the only poll that really matters is at the ballot box. And I just wish that we would wait until that poll is completed to make political decisions.
Well, okay, so you are suggesting that media coverage is dictating the decisions that people make, as opposed to covering it.
Yeah,
in a lot. That's a very specific philosophical decision. Because I would disagree with that. I believe that, at least from my perspective as somebody that's in the media, I do not view myself as programming anybody. I believe that I am desperately trying to find any wisp of a representation of what's happening and trying to make it a thing. And polling is an example of that.
Yeah, but I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about, like, with all due respect,
them.
The people that are actually being watched, the people on the TV, the corporatocracy, yes. Those type of people. And those are the people that, like, with the Commission on Presidential Debates, for instance, they are making decisions about who gets to be in those debates based on corporate polling now. They've changed the rules, and I think is a problem.
Hold on, let's be clear on this. They're doing whatever the fuck they want, which is to maintain the duopoly,
yeah.
And they're using polls to justify that decision. But if the polls change, they're going to have we're not going to have an independent or a libertarian in that again, even if the polls say so.
But that's kind of beside the point. The point is that the polls are being used as criteria to decide who gets to be on that stage. And like, you're right, Fred. Like, I think that it is. Based on how the Commission on Presidential Debates came to be, it was the Democrats and Republicans deciding together to cut out the League of Women Voters. You're absolutely right about everything you just said. But my point is that these polls are making decisions, and these are not votes. These are, like I said, these are collections of a selected group of people's opinions based on who is taking the poll, what result they want. And in this case, on the presidential debate scale, it is the Democrats and Republicans who are deciding which boomers to call and what polls are going to be used to decide who gets to stand on those stages. And I think that is a problem.
So Jen, you make wonderful points. I am curious, with say like a debate within a Republican or Democratic primary, where there are maybe 40 candidates running, but there's a limited amount of stage time and there's a limited amount of spots, it would seem to me that polling would probably be the best way by which to do that. I mean, you could do like signatures. That's an alternate method, which is
can I tell you, these are the methods that are actually being used for the first Republican debate. It is 40,000 individual donations, which is something that the Democrats started last cycle.
Oh, okay. I withdraw my critique. It sounds like there's a better method to do it.
Hold on. You're right. 1% in 3 qualifying polls. So a lot of folks with higher name recognition have cleared the polling threshold. They have not cleared the individual donation threshold, except for some of them that are using very interesting and financially lucrative for you, the listener, Perry Johnson and I believe Doug Burgum are clearing that threshold by giving you a $20 gift card if you give them a $1 donation to get over that 40,000 donor hump.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So you can be making money on this election because they are burning a pile of money so they can get on stage.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I could see polls being useful in a situation like that. Actually, now that I'm saying it out, probably ballots or like signatures would probably be the best way to do it. But absent that, I could see polls being used before the election as just a way to allocate stage time, I think. Or not stage time, stage allocation.
Yeah. Let me make a few points in terms of the polling industry itself. Landlines are still the most reliable way to be able to talk to somebody for 30 minutes. And Jen is right. Less and less people have landlines. I don't have a landline. I don't think either you two have a landline. It's been a long time since we probably did.
I don't have that a being place said, to live.
Yeah. That being said,
Jen has a really fucking long cord and a rotary phone that she takes everywhere with her.
There are cell phone. People do call cell phones for polls. It's just that cell phones are less reliable to get somebody on the phone for 30 minutes. And there is online only polling. The problem is that both of those are just not as reliable as landlines. Now, that being said, while we can get into specific polling that comes out of what is referred to in the industry as a push poll, so something that is statistically maybe not the most rigorous, but shows a result that you would like to manifest into the world. Those do exist, but especially in our world of polling aggregates, reliable polls that have a better track record compared to the end result or demonstrate that a certain electorate moved one way or another that was correct are recorded. Like there are resources like 538 that do grade polling firms based on accuracy, based on numerical accuracy. So I don't think that it is totally accurate to say that this is just complete kabuki theater.
I just think that hurts more than it helps. That's all.
Okay.
There you go.
Well, what do you think, dear listener? We'll sample 100 of you. Patreon.com/We're Not Wrong. This week, we're going to be talking about the conservative celebration over the U.S. Women's World Cup team flameout. Why? Why are they so excited that these women disappointed out there in New Zealand? We find out on this Patreon episode. Of course, Patreon is where you can get the bonus topic for all of you freebie folks. You only get 2. Patreon folks get 3. And we are moving our way toward 1,000 patrons. Very exciting. Very exciting. Patreon.com/We're Not Wrong. Oh, also, please go ahead and check your credit card. Patreon sent everybody these emails because there's a dispute with one of their vendors. So double check your Patreons. If you're not getting, if you're like, oh, did they just not do a Patreon episode last week? No, we're always doing a Patreon episode. So if you just did not get it, make sure that you are still subscribed. There was some weird thing. So Double check it. Patreon.com/We're Not Wrong.
Congressional Dish is now back below 1,000. Every month it goes back below 1,000. And where We're Not Wrong rebounded, my show has not. So.
Oh, no.
The competition is reignited.
Well, yeah, there always is a burp in the first week. But that's like people whose credit cards are not, like they were expired and they have to give a new credit card. But apparently it was more of a thing this time because of back end horseshit.
Mine went down significantly and never rebounded. So I don't know. So maybe people just hate our current
Patreon numbers, are they reflected in this new reality? Or is it going to be next month where we see the drop?
I don't think that we're going to see a monetary drop per se.
We're Not Wrong is back to where it was last month. It's my show that took the hit. We're Not Wrong is fine. I mean, we still need to get more patrons, obviously.
We need to get more. I mean, come on. We need to show year-on-year growth or else the shareholders will be in revolt. we are at 910 members as we speak here.
Yeah, so 90.
So only 90 more. And then we eclipse 1,000. Very, very exciting times. How about some terrifying times, huh? The United States deployed 4 Navy warships in response to Russian and Chinese naval forces conducting joint patrols near Alaska's Aleutian Islands, as reported by the Wall Street Journal. Although 11 Russian and Chinese ships never entered U.S. territorial waters, they were shadowed by 4 U.S. destroyers and a P-8 Poseidon aircraft. Brent Sadler, a retired Navy captain and senior research fellow at the Heritage Foundation, described the event as, quote, a historical first and highlighted its provocative nature, especially considering ongoing tensions in Ukraine and around Taiwan. The U.S. Northern Command confirmed the event, assuring that their assets acted in defense of the U.S. and Canada and noted that the patrol stayed in international waters and wasn't viewed as a threat. Alaska's Republican senators Dan Sullivan and Lisa Murkowski emphasized the strategic importance of Alaska due to its proximity to both China and Russia. They had been in constant communication with the Alaska Command and were briefed on the foreign vessel's activities. The Chinese embassy in Washington, D.C. stated that the joint patrol wasn't directed at Washington and was part of the annual cooperation plan between the Chinese and Russian militaries. This isn't the first instance of such naval operations near Alaska, however. Sullivan and Murkowski recalled similar operations in 2022, urging a more robust response to future activities. Furthermore, in September of 21, U.S. Coast Guard cutters encountered Chinese ships near the Aleutian Islands, with the first such encounter dating back to 2015. In an unrelated story, the White House is pushing for Congress to authorize another tranche of military and financial support to Ukraine to help them defend against the ongoing Russian invasion. And so I ask you, Andrew Heaton, is this related to what is happening in Ukraine?
Sure looks like it to me. I think that we've done a very, very intense job trying to isolate Russia from everybody except China, thereby pushing Russia into China's arms. Meanwhile, setting a global stage where China benefits from a prolonged conflict between America via a proxy war and Russia. And we also keep saying things like we've got to defeat Russia to show China that they can't do stuff with Taiwan. I'm hearing this regularly, both in public and in private, fairly confident the Chinese are smart enough to pick up on it. I think that we've almost facilitated an alliance between China and Russia, which is the dumbest geopolitical thing we could possibly do. And I think now you're beginning to see the fruits of that. We've pushed together a group that we shouldn't have done. Like back, I have very mixed thoughts on Richard Nixon, but something very smart he did was go over to China and drive a wedge between them and the Soviet Union and keep them from teaming up during the Cold War. Thanks, Nixon. That's something we ought to be doing right now. We're doing the opposite of that. We're pushing China and Russia closer together. They're running joint drills off the Aleutian Islands, as Justin just said. And it makes total sense to me. If I were China and I were watching America talk about how we have to defeat Russia to show China who's boss with Taiwan, I would begin to go, well, I guess the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And if I were Russia, I'd be trying to get money and guns from China. And so I think we're facilitating this. I think it's a very large misstep. We're beginning to see how this is having other effects merely besides all of the myriad things that are going on right now in Ukraine?
I have said before that if president, when elected president, my first foreign policy priority would be to spread scurrilous rumors between Russia and China. I would go, my first meeting with President Xi would be, hey, look, I just want to tell you, I don't agree with Putin calling you a big fat baby bitch. I think that that's way across the line. I would just do that and then just let everything else play out. Jen, do you think this is about Ukraine?
I mean, I agree with every word that Andrew said. And actually, to add to that, we just found out that some of the Ukraine money is going to be diverted to have weapons that are going to be purchased for Taiwan. And as Andrew said, in so many hearings, I have heard that we must have victory in Ukraine to send a message to China. So it's like we have connected those two issues on purpose. And then just economically, I do also have to point out that both countries are concerned about our stewardship of the global economic system because we have abused our sanctions power. And so when we went after Russia in the way we did, pretty unilaterally. I mean, we didn't do it through the World Trade Organization or the UN. We did it on our own. China looked at that and said, this is something they want to do against us eventually. And it made them decide to go and lean in further on this BRICS system so they could create an alternative payment system in the countries of the world that do not want to have their balls held by the United States and squeezed. And so I think we have to look at our own actions here and see how we have kind of facilitated the need for that partnership. And I am with Andrew in that I think that it was a very, very bad strategic mistake.
Let's add that right now the country that's winning the war between Ukraine and Russia is China. Mm-hmm. That is the country that is benefiting from this. If I were China right now, I would be looking at this going, so America, China is the only peer competitor that the United States has. Russia is not a peer competitor with the United States.
No.
Russia is a thing because it has nukes. Its economy is smaller than Italy.
Yeah.
Its army is a mess.
As John McCain used to say, it is a gas station with a UN seat.
Yes. Mm-hmm. China is a peer competitor, and it's an up-and-coming peer competitor that wants to have a lot more clout, if not lead an alternate world order in the very near future. And if I'm China and I'm looking at America as a peer competitor that is currently top dog that I might be able to take down pretty quick, I am very happy with the United States pouring billions and billions of dollars into a proxy war, which is what we're doing, a proxy war in Ukraine where we're not really affected by it. Meanwhile, I'm also planning to absolutely invade Taiwan because it is part of China, blah, 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 sacred. I mean, it's not even a geopolitical concern for them. It is like if Rhode Island or like if Virginia somehow was a part of another country, like we would have to go get Virginia. Like they're absolutely going to invade it at some point. And America's attention is now very focused on Eastern Europe, Russia, Ukraine. It has limited bandwidth. Resources are being funneled there. This is great for China. So for all the people that are like, we got to send a message to China, I think the message we're sending them is, you got this, buddy.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that we have talked a lot about over the last few years, which is what is referred to in military circles as the Pacific pivot, that the ending of the Afghanistan debacle was a meaningful closing of a chapter of the United States focusing on the Middle East militarily, and that we were slowly turning our eye of Sauron across the Pacific Ocean to our biggest geopolitical foe, which would be China. And so I think that's the reason why we keep talking about, oh, it's about Taiwan. It's about Taiwan. It's about Taiwan. Because even while we are funding this proxy war with Russia, which has been a State Department bugaboo for, 10 plus years, the Pentagon understands that no. It's the babies being born now or born in the last 5 years that would be going to war in China, not anywhere in Europe or the Middle East. And that's the lesson that they want to hammer in, is that's where the threat is. The threat is in China. The threat is in Beijing.
To back that up, seems to be this idea that there are Republicans in Congress that are now anti-war because they're not, you know, full-throatedly supporting the money going to Ukraine. But those same exact humans are advocating more aggression towards China. So we're kind of getting endless war no matter what. It's just which sphere of influence is more important to you. But there is no one in this Congress right now that is saying we should stop all this shit. That doesn't exist in the 118th Congress.
Well, Jen, there's not a lot of money in that position. It's pretty like, first of all, theoretically, if I wanted to maybe like launder money, endless war would be great because I could just figure out how to send it to Afghanistan or Ukraine or Taiwan or whatever. We could work it all out. But I realize this is getting into boilerplate, but I think that Eisenhower was right about the military-industrial congressional complex, what he originally wanted to call it, but decided to drop congressional because he didn't want to piss off Congress. I think he's right about that. It is a deeply entrenched interest. You have folks like... I would normally expect like Bernie Sanders to be very anti-war, but like he's in favor of the, I'm going to butcher this, the F-35 program because it like makes a lug nut in Vermont. And so everybody has a hand in this pot. And unfortunately, there's not very many people that are either taking a principled or ideological position because it's just there's really not a lot of that. There's very much a consensus within Congress of we should have a interventionist liberal democracy. We should be a global policeman. This is something that I like seeing percolating in the Republican Party is there are some like latent isolationist tendencies there. I think it would be very healthy for America if we actually had foreign policy debates. I'm unaware of really any that we've had, like serious debates where the actual people are that are in charge are debating stuff. It seems to me that there's very much a consensus there. And I've not been following them. You're probably right, though, Jen, that the isolationists on Europe are probably China war hawks at the same time.
They are.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if that is a political lane for the voter, because ultimately this comes down to whether or not they are able to make it to Congress. And that's where the political element comes in and whether or not you are going to run on the idea of, you know, somewhere between we should get out of X, Y, or Z and, you know, Fortress America was what it was commonly referred to back in the 40s and 50s. Which was a very isolationist. We should not be post-World War II. What they're going to do is what they're going to do, and that's that. And we've had little flirtations with ideas along those lines since then. Like the most meaningful was from, you know, during the early 90s, the Air Force had kind of a moment of ascendancy in the Pentagon. And they sold Clinton on the idea of like, hey, we can be effectively isolationist, so we can delegate to other people, other countries and other regions. You guys solve your problems. We're not going to solve your problems. And then if we need to solve a little problem, we can always just drop a missile on them. And that'll smarten everything up and we can solve. It's great taste, less filling. You never have any ground troops and we still get to be a big baddie on the world stage. Everything's great. And guess what? That lasted about a year and a half until we had Kosovo and we had, you know, Somalia and stuff like that, where it became very, very clear that just blindly dropping bombs with no other interaction in the country was not a great look for the United States. In fact, it tended to make more problems than less. And also the rest of the world didn't really believe our promise that we would stay out of things. When everything was happening in Bosnia, it was the Europeans that were looking at us and saying, they won't be able to help themselves. They'll get involved. And then sure enough, the American military and UN helmets eventually showed up.
Quick anecdote about us bombing Bosnia, Herzegovina and Kosovo and all of that. When I was backpacking through Europe in my early 20s, I swung through Belgrade, Serbia, and I went to this chapel that's a military chapel. Interesting slash a little creepy because the chandeliers were all made out of bullets. So it was a chapel, but it was
sounds so metal.
Yes, it was the most like Patton-esque Eastern Orthodox church I've ever been in. And I'm wandering around looking at stuff, and I don't, somebody recognized that I wasn't Serbian, and they went, where are you from? And I went, I'm American. And they go, oh, our priest speaks English. We'll get the priest for you. So he comes over, he starts giving me a tour, and he's pointing things out, and then he points to an icon of the Theotokos, and he goes, and this was given to us by the Patriarch of Moscow when the Americans were bombing Serbia. And I, trying to be funny, went, yeah, sorry about bombing you, Father. And he goes, oh, no, I didn't mean to make you feel bad. We know that wasn't the American people. That was the American government and the Serbian government. You're not implicated in this. I hope I didn't make you feel uncomfortable. We're doing a wedding tomorrow. Please come. You can be my guest. It was one of the nicest things ever. And then I showed up late and they took me to another wedding. Really nice. I had a great time. I had a great time in Serbia. Wonderful people, Serbians.
I would love to see this version of Wedding Crashers. The Andrew Heaton starring vehicle of him just like in the montage of falling into bed with all of these wayward Serbian women.
I should go back. I will point out, I think one of the other reasons that it's difficult to remove any of this apparatus and the giant military state we have, I think the main reason, the predominant reason, is that there are very, very deep structural incentives for members of Congress to create jobs in their district. I think that really is the main thing. It's difficult to root that out. But after that, there are some secondary causes that are also very difficult to root out. One of them is wars are real popular. And I know that that's a weird counterintuitive thing to say, but they are. Like when the Enlightenment kicked off, and we finally, for the first time in human history, we begin to have this moment where we go, what if we're not all playthings for dukes? What if we're not just toy soldiers for feudal lords? We all kind of have our own worth. What if we just like made our own decisions? And when the Enlightenment kicks off, there's this wonderful period where they go, now that we're bringing on democracy, war will not be a thing anymore, because the average man will not be gaining anything from invading Burgundy. That was something that the lords benefited from. And they found that it went the other way, that war was very popular with the masses once the masses were enfranchised into the democratic process. I think probably because for a lot of people, their own self-esteem becomes tied up in that of the nation. And if my nation's out kicking ass, it means I'm kicking ass. And so there's this purchase there. And then the other bit is, I think, something that just goes deeply to how we fund everything, which is that there's a very common mindset in the United States that money just sort of materializes from someplace, and if something's worth funding, we should fund it, and it just comes from wherever money comes from. Ukraine is a good example of that, where I think the majority of people in America right now are, we should be funding them and funding them to the hilt. And then, you know, I look at it and go, well, maybe there are arguments to be made here, but we do have a limited amount of funding. And I would posit that an indefinite proxy war is probably a worse use of funding than like building homes for homeless people or just giving it back to the taxpayer. There are other things that I think would actually be better. But I don't think most people are approaching it like that. Like, we've got a limited pot and we're going to take this money in our limited pot in a country with a lot of problems, and we're going to go do a proxy war with Russia because they're permanently evil. It's more like, no, it just sort of materializes from the air, and you're an asshole if you want to stop that materializing money from going into the thing that it ought to go to.
Okay, so I feel a little gross defending the pro-war people, but I do think the intentions are good and the support. I think they see Ukrainians as victims of a aggressive neighbor, and they want to support those Ukrainians, which true. I would understand. I do understand, actually. The three of us made a Ukrainian friend who I think about all the time. And I want to support that effort. However, we are now a year and a half into this, and we still don't know what the goal is. And that is where I draw the problem. It's like, I want to support you in maybe a goal of finding, you know, whatever the new borders should be. But if the goal is taking back all the territory, including Crimea, which is absolutely going to make this a much bigger war than it currently is. I mean, I think we have to define what the goal is. Is it every square inch of territory? Is it regime change in Russia, which has been suggested by our State Department?
That's what it is. It's how long do we have to turn up the pressure before Putin dies? That's essentially what our fairly naked plan is.
Well, So far, it has not been spelled out to the American people or to our Congress. There is still a question mark, even though we have our suspicions that that's it. And if that is, in fact, it, I don't think that's what the American people are supporting. I think they're actually supporting the people of Ukraine. And so I think that's where the disconnect is. And I think we have to keep in mind the good intentions of the American people and how Congress is manipulating us to support goals that are beyond what we think they are.
Very, very well put. Well put. And I think probably the majority of listeners of this program, based on the mail that I've seen, the majority of the listeners on my program, I think it, in general, most Americans are very much, for good reason, in the pro-Ukraine camp. Ukraine was invaded by Russia. Like, I think you're right on all of that. And I'm glad that you did that, because I don't want to misalign the intentions of so many people. But I also agree with your other analysis that Congress is taking advantage of that. And then I would add also that in the domestic realm, with all policy, you should always be judging a policy based on the outcome and not the intention. So if I go, we're going to help poor people, how? We're going to give them all accordions. My intentions might be very good, mm-hmm. but that may not be the best way to tackle poverty. And what you should be concerning yourself with is not the intentions behind the bill that I'm proposing, but rather what the outcome would be. Because I might be a great guy with great – this happens all the time. There are most of the bills that I disagree with – politically in Congress are from people trying to do the right thing. I just think that they're incompetent, or I think that they have a fundamental mismatch between their ideology and reality, and that the outcome will be bad. But the intention is generally good. And what we have to do is concern ourselves with what the outcome would be. On the foreign policy stage, to me, the worst outcome is always going to be nuclear war. But fortunately, I'm not at red alert on that. I'm at like yellow alert on that. I think the more likely bad outcome that I am very worried about is that we just prolong this, and in the process, we kill an entire generation of Ukrainian young men, we ruin their country, and then the outcome ends up being Russia still gets about half of Ukraine. And I don't want that to happen. If the outcome is through good intention that we just bleed Ukraine dry and it doesn't end up with a positive thing, then that is a bad place to be, however good the intention was that ignited it.
Agreed.
Heaton, I would support your accordion-based pork barrel polka.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's a shame that I have such an antipathy to pork barrel spending, because I think did you ever see News Radio?
Of course, yeah.
Okay, great program. One of the last great
sitcoms. One of the greatest sitcom casts of all time.
Absolutely. And Stephen Root is this brilliant, eccentric billionaire. I feel like if I were into pork barrel spending, I would be the Stephen Root of pork barrel spending. I would be the one that's like, blimp subsidies, like trying to get subsidies for what are the flash mobs? I'd be like the flash mob congressman. There'd be all sorts of fun shit if I could just get over the principles.
Well, maybe one day.
Hopefully I'll become more corrupt and popular, and someday these things can be in your town.
That's what I hope, that's your long-term arc, that we eventually just make you very rich and very corrupt and die.
Popular.
Yeah, and popular. And you die surrounded by hundreds of thousands as your gnarled finger grasps your last dollar.
Three-way in Serbia. We could circle back to that. It could be a callback.
There you go.
If you want to participate in a Serbian three-way with Andrew Heaton, then we want you to email we'renotwrongpod@gmail.com. In a locked room with only a corpse and a puddle of water. We'renotwrongpod@gmail.com. Word Police writes, does Justin ever get flack for pedantically using either instead of neither, but incorrectly using for which all the time?
No, jerk offs.
I actually have. I've gotten a lot more. People have pointed out that I say for which a lot.
I've noticed that, but like, why does anyone care? That's the word police make me insane.
I had somebody reach out, bring up that you use for whom incorrectly, but
for whom? That was it. For whom, not for which? Yeah, for whom?
I say whom when I want to sound pretentious. That's it. That's the whole thing. I don't know how the grammar works. I don't understand the grammar.
No,
it's like in the same way that like while and whilst are interchangeable. And if I want to be kind of funny, I'll say whilst.
Here's
the same thing with whom.
Here's the reality, folks. When you are doing one mic radio or any kind of podcasting for which you are talking a lot, I just did it again.
For which?
For which? You need time to think of things
while you are talking. And so your sentences not only become further apart, but they also start including different crutch words because you need to think of things to say. So keep pointing them out. That's fine. It's not the most pleasant thing to hear, but it shows you're listening, and that is what matters. That and you paying us money at patreon.com/we're not wrong.
I want to register that I find you're all annoying when you send in messages like that. Just stop it. We're doing the best we can.
And for anybody that wants to learn better public speaking, I think you should mimic William Shatner for all the reasons that Justin just brought up. Saying like a lot is a bad filler word. Mm. Saying is a really bad filler word. Like, and I am guilty of this myself. But if you're a really good public speaker, you banish from your vocabulary and you just take a dramatic pause when you would otherwise say which is why William Shatner is a wonderful prototype for anybody of we will. And you remember what you're going to say. Go in there.
Yeah.
Right. You just like it's a great way to do it.
Well, I've learned about the pauses because you're right. That's what the likes and the are. Is there? It's where you're supposed to pause. And what I've learned from listening back to myself is a lot of times the pauses feel unnatural to do, but don't sound bad at all.
No.
So I've worked on that, but I don't need any jerk offs to be writing to me to tell me that I said
I speak for the jerk offs here from the jerk off delegation. Well, look, I get it the most. You didn't get. I was all on Twitter this week. All on Twitter was people shitting on for whom. I know. And I appreciate it from your perspective because you're a creator. You actually understand what it is like to get piled on by a bunch of people that say they love you, but are attacking you, or at least the way that you read it as a creator is an attack.
Yeah.
That being said, I choose to not think of them as humans, but rather just bodies that are listening to my content. They count for a download, and I hope to convert them into a patron. That's what I choose to think.
I keep planning to put the Political Orphanage on YouTube. I will at some point. We've done it a couple of times, but I've never regularized it. And what I need to do is if you ever have a correction where, you know, Heaton, you made a joke about the Christmas truce being in 1913, but it was in 1940, whatever. You have to put that on YouTube because then it helps the algorithm because you're commenting. Like, I need to figure out how to use this as fuel, as a propulsive element.
Take Me to Your Leader writes, the strongest piece of evidence against the existence of aliens is that Trump never brought it up. The president's supposed to have access to the highest levels of intelligence, and it strains credulity that he wouldn't try to distract us from his weekly scandal with a bombshell like that.
I thought so, too. And then I made the UFO episode. And the thing that David Grush was actually whistleblowing on was not the fact that there might be aliens, although that was rad. But what he was trying to tell Congress was that there were secret programs that were being hidden from Congress and presumably probably the president. And where they're being hidden is inside of corporations. From what I understand from David Grush, he's reporting is that they are using research and development money and diverting that into these secret programs and not informing Congress appropriately. So there is actually a very good chance that Trump wouldn't have had the documents, wouldn't have had the information, because I thought so too. I was like, he would absolutely want to tell us this, but if he didn't know, then he couldn't. So that was a key part of that hearing that I don't think anyone is talking about because of the whole aliens part of it. But yeah, that diversion of money into private contractors was the key to that whistleblowing hearing.
I remain an alien skeptic, although I think I have the best sci-fi credentials of anybody on this panel. I would love it. I remain a skeptic. However, I will say I've got Michael Glennon coming on in about a month, writing about what I would call the deep state. He would not use that terminology, but basically like the fourth branch of government, the national security apparatus. And one of the things that I talked to him about was, you know, doesn't Congress have, you know, prima facie ability to walk into any branch of government within the feds and say, I want to see your data on this? And it's like, yeah, maybe. I mean, a lot of the time the military will say this is on a need to know basis. But even when they don't claim that, it also means that they're coming forward and doing it. And there are lots of examples where like the CIA, I think, like the CIA had recorded waterboarding. Like it had recorded it. There was video footage of this. And they didn't tell Congress because they didn't think Congress needed to know. So Congress could have asked them, do you have any footage of waterboarding people? Because we'd really like to see if it's torture or not. And then legally they would have had to supply it. But they didn't mention it, so Congress never knew to ask. Again, I don't think there are any aliens, but I don't know that Trump would have known.
Well, the CIA just wanted to keep it a surprise for the Christmas party, you know, when they play the compilation. IPA explainer writes, some people hate IPAs for the same reason that some people think cilantro tastes like soap. There's a genetic marker that allows about 30% of the population to taste a chemical in cilantro and hops that is soapy and highly bitter. The other 70% are unaware of this chemical and say it just adds floral and citrus notes. So the reason that IPAs are super offensive is that they have 3 to 6 times the amount of hops versus a standard beer. I thought that was fascinating.
Interesting.
Well, the cilantro thing is true, but hops just taste bad to like all humans. Some of you have acquired the taste, but they taste bad.
How do you get to
say that?
I'm the authority on these things.
You're the authority. Yes. Okay. I'm going to have to see the polling on that. Ranked choice argument writes, I keep getting swayed on ranked choice voting based on who is talking at any time. I know Justin and Andrew are on different sides of the issue. So let's say that you're all dock workers at the bar loudly debating the merits of ranked choice voting. I add editorially a common occurrence here in the United States of America. Jen is the annoyed bartender that keeps telling you to not talk politics at the bar right before correcting some dumb shit you just said. Please solve this issue once and for all.
On
ranked
choice,
you want to go or you want me to?
No, I vote no on this entire improv exercise. I feel like there's enough conversation about ranked choice voting.
I figured that we were just like giving our pitch on it.
And I agree with your pitch. I don't know why they think we disagree on ranked choice voting. I think it's a great idea.
Can we try this? I think this would be interesting. Justin, can you and I steel man each other's position?
Sure. Yeah.
You definitely heard me rant about it enough.
Yeah,
you
yeah,
should
yeah.
be able to do this.
Yeah, 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 yeah. You want me to go first or you can go first?
I'll be you.
Okay.
This is Justin's position. America is a go big or go home country. And trying to get a European nuanced, detailed blah, 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 blah thing is going to end up having a bunch of little micro decisions. But what we really ought to have is just big old one of a couple of decisions that you lost it. I failed at this.
I should have went first. Okay? I should have went first.
Justin, are you against ranked choice voting? Because we were both Oakland residents. We used it. Did you not?
That's exactly the reason why I am not against it.
Okay.
I am just skeptical that it is the cure-all that many people make it out to be. It won't
be a cure-all. Like, and by the way, there's going to be negative stuff that comes from it, too. Like, there's an asterisk here because many people would say that this has already happened. However, in the United States, historically, because we have a duopoly, the, like, out-and-out, like, neo-Nazi blood and soil party doesn't exist. Because there's not going to it can't find purchase within the big party. The bigger party is going to squelch that. If you have ranked choice voting, you're probably going to get a bunch of weird fucking crazy parties that get up in there. That happens in Europe all the time. But I trust that they are not going to actually win. They are going to be a release valve for a minority of people that share that position. And what it would really do is allow us to enfranchise a greater amount of people in the political process, actually represent the views of the American people better, and probably result in a lot smarter and less extreme candidates overall.
Yeah, my take is I think ranked choice voting tends to be the haven of systems obsessed thinkers who are frustrated by humans and
just pointing at
who and feel that in their inability to actually persuade people that what we really need to do is change the rules and that will make the people behave better. And while I do think that there are actual things that can come from ranked choice voting, and I would point to the examples that ranked choice voting advocates like Andrew Yang point to, like with or open primary and ranked choice voting, a lot of the voting reform stuff. I do think that there are good examples of it, but I also think that when you are so systems obsessed that you believe that it is only the systems that is stopping the outcomes that you would like to happen in the world, and if we only flip these two levers, you become so up your own technocratic ass that you don't understand the underpinnings of humanity.
Let's be very clear on this. I will never get my way in this or any country. I am always going to be the losing side. I am aware of that. Like when I'm in the United Kingdom and people are like, what party would you be? And I'm like, who's losing worst right now? And they're like, well, it'll be the Lib Dems. And I'm like, probably the Lib Dems then.
Yeah, I'm going to say the Lib Dems.
Oh, they're kind of like classical liberals with social democracy. And I'm like, there you fucking go. Look at that. The one thing that I will correct for you, Justin, is it's not that I think that ranked choice voting is a way to manipulate people or to somehow nudge them into my preferred view. That is not at all what I see myself doing. What I see right now is we have a system that ideologically gerrymanders the electorate so that it's not accurately reflecting the actual majority will of the people. I'm probably going to disagree with that will, but what I want to do is remove a distortion in the democratic process. So I'm not trying to distort the process to arrive at my conclusion. I'm trying to remove the distortion wholesale.
And that's the problem, though, is that I don't think that ranked choice voting as it exists in Oakland and San Francisco has made that political world any less distorted than it was before they put those in.
Can I ask, so Oklahoma City, where I'm from, has ranked choice voting and it has open primaries. And the result is that we have Mayor David Holt, who is the exact kind of person that I wish was a Republican. I wish he was the exemplar of Republicans in the country. He's a really smart. Some would describe him as technocratic conservative who brought back the Civil Rights Commission and marches in one of our two dueling gay pride parades. That's right, San Francisco. We've got two gay pride parades because we couldn't make up our mind on some detail I don't fully understand. But I talked to him about it and I went, you were clearly out of sync with the Republican Party nationally. How did and you're in Oklahoma. How did you make this happen? And he was like, oh, it's because we have ranked choice. Without me prompting him, it's because we have ranked choice voting and open primaries. And as a result, I can run a campaign where I appeal to moderates, independents, and Democrats,
yes,
as opposed to just. And so you end up getting somebody that better reflects the overall consensus of the population, as opposed to a kind of false dichotomy between the extremist and two warring tribes.
And I would say that is cherry picking the hit and not counting the misses, because there are other places that have ranked choice voting where the shit is exactly the same as it would be. It's just a more complicated way to vote.
Well, okay, but I don't know Oakland. San Francisco voted 97-3 on Biden Trump, right?
Yes.
So like in that instance, my guess is you're going to get a bunch of Democrats in San Francisco, regardless of how you slice it, because San Francisco is so Democratic. You might have ideological variation within that spectrum that you don't currently see. There might be more neoliberal leaning Democrats that get more of a piece. I don't know. But like if Oakland's super Democrat, why would you think ranked choice voting would affect the outcome of that?
Well, if the argument is that it stops polarization or capture based on polarization, then theoretically there should be people, even if it is to the left, it is not all the way to the left in the way that the candidates that tend to come out of the fairly ideologically captured area of the Bay Area, regions of the Bay Area, continue to produce. And you know, basically that's I'm kind of cribbing off a guest that I had on a while ago, and I can't remember his name right now, but he did a long-term study of ranked choice voting in places that it exists in America. And his finding was that there was not a material difference. That yes, you can point out here and again examples of it doing what ranked choice voting advocates say that it should do, but by and large, it's just another way to reflect the will of the people. And sometimes that's a harder pill to swallow, is that no matter how you calculate the votes and allow for more of a moderating element to come in, some people just want the extreme thing because that's their ideology.
Sure. I think that there is data on your side for that. Like as Americans, we tend to look at our cities rather than looking at other countries to see what the experiences is. And I wish I knew more about how other countries operate. If the current polarization in the United States is a result of electoral malfeasance, as a lot of the people in the ranked choice camp claim, then theoretically we would see countries that have ranked choice voting not have that, which is not the case. I don't know how department elections work in France, but the presidential election is some variation of ranked choice voting. And I would not describe the Macron-Le Pen election as in any way convivial. The Dutch, who I know even less about, are meant to be the cutest, most wonderful, clogging social democracy of high trust, every 80% taxes, but it's fine because it's all spent like they're the most that thing. And yet they had a very contentious election with their farmer party here recently. And Scotland, where I currently am, has what they call alternate, basically ranked choice voting. They have some other term for it. And they also have proportional representation. And it's still extremely acrimonious. So I don't think it would be a cure-all. What I do think is, though, I think that it would give a voice to a lot of people right now that, as I usually say, end up having to pick between King Joffrey and Ramsay Bolton.
Yes.
And even if our screaming is for naught, I would like to be able to participate.
Okay, and you are assuming that you can't now. We're done arguing about it because we need to read On Guard's email. I believe that I have found a sport that Andrew Heaton would love so much that he would voluntarily participate in it. Fencing. Number one, is it sport that requires you to wear a sufficiently stuffy uniform that allows Mr. Heaton to dress in armor reminiscent of his impeccable taste in clothing? And is something that he can wear in the cold weather that he loves? Number two, Winston Churchill played it. Number three, it is somewhat of a thinking game, something Mr. Heaton is sure to respect. Number four, it is the type of game to be associated with the type of old stuffy aesthetic that Mr. Heaton is known to appreciate. Number five, it is a game in which Mr. Heaton's wiry frame is not a negative in the slightest. Number six, it is a great game for those people who must travel as much as Mr. Heaton, since you need to find a local club to play at rather than a team. It's easy to play as a traveler. And seven, it is a game that has age groups to play in, all the way up to senior age, something Mr. Heaton could endure in well past our current date. Are you ready to bring up arms, Mr. Heaton?
I took fencing classes in high school, only for a month, but I've actually done this before. I think I did like a total of maybe four classes, by the way. It wasn't a long-standing thing or something like that. You make really good points. These are all really good points. I appreciate that people are trying to enfranchise me into the sports process. Thank you. In much the same way that I commend my Christian friends for praying for my immortal soul, I encourage everybody in the sporty community to try and continue to invoke me in. Two things I will point out. I, as the pretentious twit in here, will say that while I don't understand football, anybody that can explain a nickel defense, I think, is also a thinking man. I think there's clearly plenty of strategy that goes into a number of sports that bore me. It's not that they're dumb. It's just that I don't find them very interesting. I really like that idea that I could just rock up to a city and participate in it. But what I tend to do is go dancing. I really like dancing. Last weekend, I went to a Kaylee here in Edinburgh. When I'm in Austin, usually once a week or so, I go two-stepping. I used to go swing dancing. I feel like that's a good thing for me because it's very it's very convivial and you can kind of just plug into it. It's always a little bit nervous the first time you do it, but you know, I get over the hump.
Not enough swords.
Yeah, I feel like dancing's more of exercise than a sport because there's no competition. But the thing about fencing that I'm really loving picturing here is you trying to get your sword through the TSA, especially on an international flight.
God damn it. I have a note from the Secretary of the Interior saying I'm allowed to take my foil.
Doom writes, Andrew Sullivan, whose opinion I respect a great deal, concluded in his most recent newsletter with a sobering prediction of the future. We quote Sullivan, "We are entering late stage democratic collapse where tribalism overwhelms reason, common trust evaporates, debate is gone, norms destroyed, and all that matters is the purity of the extremes who can win power by any means. The latest indictment of Trump, and more specifically the reaction to it, is proof of this extinction level event of liberal democracy. Future historians may look back and conclude, in fact, that it has already happened." We go back to our emailer. On one hand, it's easy to review the last few years and see a path leading directly to catastrophe. On the other hand, it's easy for the politically engaged people to view this crisis of the day as an all-consuming threat. So I'm turning it over to you. Realistically, how worried should we be? Should we prepare to say goodbye to liberal democracy, or is there still hope?
Okay, so as the person, well, I think Andrew's with me on this, but I definitely am someone who takes this third indictment very seriously. But let's tone it down a notch. One of the things that I think is great that came out of all of this is that our Constitution was just tested in a way that it was never tested before, and it withstood mm-hmm. the test. So I'm pretty enthusiastic about where we're at. The fact that we are finally holding a president accountable for something awful that they've done, I think is a good, it's a step in the right direction. Now, of course, I would like to go back and prosecute George W. for the wars, and like there are serious things that have happened that have gone unprosecuted. But we're starting to hold the highest level of politician in our country accountable for crimes. And so I'm actually not seeing this as the end of our democracy or any other such bullshit. Like, we've been hearing that January 6th was an insurrection. Like, can we just tone it down a little? Yes, we went through a test. We're okay. We're okay. So let's just see what happens with the indictment. Let's vote. Let's take care of the votes on our states. We have six states that are still voting on voting machines. In 2004, we had the Democrats that were very concerned about votes on voting machines that don't have receipts. Now we have Republicans who are very concerned about voting machines that don't have receipts. That is an area of common ground where I feel like we could change our laws and make our democracy stronger. There's opportunities in these tests to strengthen our system. And when it comes to all the stuff that Trump did, one of the outcomes of that is that now it is crystal clear in law, because Congress changed it, to say that the vice president's role is now purely ceremonial. So that was kind of like a loophole that John Eastman was trying to exploit in 2020. That loophole has
and
been
cheese
closed.
Bro.
Cheese bro. Yeah, there's
Cheese bro's memo specifically said that it was incumbent, the plan was incumbent on Pence to declare the Electoral Count Act unconstitutional.
Yeah.
And that would be something that allowed, in his memo, time for legal victories in the states to prove their case before the Supreme Court eventually ruled the Electoral Count Act constitutional. So yeah. in the cheese bro memo. That was a thing, and we're stepping on another email that just came, that also came in, but that asked if anything had been done. Yes, but they did shore up the Electoral Count Act, so nobody could legally assume that it was anything other than ceremony.
Exactly. And so when I look at this situation, we are actually in a stronger position today than we were when all of that happened. And we've now exposed some of the holes in our system that we do have the power to close. So, you know, I'm sure that paragraph was satisfying to read for the people that are panicking, but I don't think we're at panic stage, and I don't think it's helpful to panic. I think it's more helpful to look at what happened, which I think we're going to do in the trial, take notes, and then, you know, try and elect people to Congress that are interested in fixing those problems.
I am less worried than Andrew Sullivan, but more worried than Jen. I'm not so worried about Trump, and I don't see Trump as the linchpin in this. I see Trump as emblematic of a bunch of problems that are facing the country right now. I think he is a symptom rather than the cause, and whatever happens with Trump, it's not going to fix or disprove the underlying problems that are there. And long term, I am kind of worried about that. I think that we've got some structural mismatches in the United States. Like, we have a constitution which is entirely geographic for a people that's not really geographic anymore, and I think that that's resulting in a lot of problems. We have a lot of technological issues in terms of social media and things like that that we don't really know how to deal with. That we might just deal with it over time, but I think that we're probably going to need like some serious structural overhaul in the next 10 or 20 years, or I'd be kind of worried about the continuance of the country as a union. But it's, you know, a little bit further away.
Yeah, the system. Fix the system. That's the solution. It's always fixing the system. Look,
structure all the way down.
Yeah, we don't need to. System.
Yeah. Okay. Look, here's the thing. Look back in modern history. How do you think we would be reacting if the president got shot, killed? The number one civil rights leader had been shot and killed. The brother of the president who was running for president was shot and killed. We have been through process, and that was only what, 70 years ago that that happened, or 80 years ago that that happened. This was not in a bygone era. It was only in the 60s that we had world leaders being shot dead in the streets because we had such unrest in our country. That worries me a lot more. I think that right now we are in an era of existential crises. And I don't know whether or not it's because of our ability to collect and communicate with each other on the internet, but it has brought all of our anxieties to a head. And I'm not here to say that any of them are more or less valid. I am saying that we are aware of them more than ever, and we are reminded of them more than ever, and we tend to spend a lot more time in our modern world thinking about things that may or may not happen in the next 10 or 20 years than we did in the past when things were a little bit more present. So I'm glad that Andrew Sullivan's Substack is doing well. That's what I'm glad.
Great guy. Love Andrew Sullivan. Great guy.
Political high school.
I interviewed him here a couple of years ago, and he didn't show up. And so I texted him and was like, hey, we're supposed to be doing an interview right now. And then all caps, oh, shit, I'm on the beach. And then he scheduled it again, and it was really nice. I like that guy.
Political high school beef writes, I went to Lake Oswego High School, which is a really affluent public high school just south of Portland, Oregon. It's a rich kid high school where island-owning millionaires send their kids because the education is competitive with private school. Many homes in the area still have the non-enforceable original no blacks redlining in their mortgage agreements, and the students are about what you would expect. In 1966, an impressionable young Afghani man got his first taste of the West at this high school. He learned the importance of money, having his daddy buy his way out of problems, and other rich kid things in the 60s. Ask Keaton. I think he attended high school in this era. Young man then returned to the Middle East with these lessons cemented. And in the summer of 2021, it was with no surprise to me that as Afghanistan crumbled, when strong leadership was critically important, Ashraf Ghani, a Lake Oswego High School alumni and president of Afghanistan, fled the country with as much cash from the treasury that he could fit inside of his helicopters.
That's amazing.
Wow. I've got a high
school Hall
of
Fame email. Hall of Fame email. Great. Continue to send in your political your political high school beefs. I want as many of these as possible.
Justin, I've got a gripe. I want to clarify something. Didn't you have to throw your high school reunion? Didn't you organize that?
I partially organized it, yes, because I was foolish enough to win an election when I was 18.
Right. See, I was vice president of my high school graduating class, and very unfortunately, the president died in the last year. And so I was like, I guess I'm going to have to organize the high school reunion. And I've been putting it off, and I was like, I got to do this. I'm going to see if anybody else is you know, worried about this. So I reached out to a couple of people, and they're like, yeah, it's next week. Did you not? So they fucking threw a reunion without fucking telling me. And by the way, it is a non-germane high school reunion, Deer Creek grads. That is an illegitimate reunion because you didn't go through the legitimate president of the student council graduating class of 2023. I will be throwing a real exiled reunion.
Yeah. You want to know what? I've changed my mind. Democracy is in trouble. Potential heat and locations writes, Heaton, move to the Pacific Northwest. It's currently 62 degrees and cloudy in the middle of August. It rarely breaks 90 all during the summer, and the average temperature for 9 months is 50 or lower. You want cold? You want gray? You want a little damp most of the time? There's no better place. Plus, there's no income tax in Washington State.
The Pacific Northwest is beautiful. It is such a beautiful, beautiful place. It's so green. The temperature is clement. I really like all of that's accurate. It reminds me of like indoor, I really like Portland. I've been to Portland a few times, and it's sort of like if Portland were like Portland wants to be like a Scandinavian colony, and they kind of act that way, dress that way. Their houses look like it. But the Pacific Northwest is beautiful. So we just have to figure out a pied de terre and then make that happen.
So the reason that has me in stitches is that my husband, Joe, who you guys know, he was raised in Portland. And when we started dating, we were like 22 years old. And I just told him straight up, I will never live in Portland. And the reason was the weather is awful. There's like 8 months out of the year where it fluctuates between 33 and 35 degrees. And it's not real rain. It's this misty bullshit rain that just gets into your clothes and is unescapable because you're basically living in a cloud. And then their claims to fame, like the things to do there, you can drink beer, eat donuts yep. and watch strippers. Yep. And
yes, I'm not into strip clubs, famous strip clubs.
Yeah.
Mary's Club, Mary's Club, Mary's Club in Portland. Shout out to Mary's Club in Portland. The strippers, I think it's a co-op, but the strippers walk up on stage and then ask the patrons, and they're all sitting at effectively cafeteria seats. So it's like, do you even have a little desk in front of you? And they just ask the people that are there, what do you guys want to hear? And some dude is just like, Lil Wayne, and they just punch it in to a jukebox and then do their dance. It is one of the most amazing strip club cities in America.
I got invited to go to a burlesque show or cabaret show last week that was put on by a local strip club. So it was really just a strip club at the Fringe Festival. I've been now to 3 stripping events, and I've not liked any of them. And the last one I went to, if I could rename it, I don't know what it was called in the bill, but I would call it Pink Gargoyles. And I have never been more alarmed. I don't think I'll ever have an erection again. It was just a horrible show.
I don't know if I want to ask 0 or a million questions, but we'll move on.
Let's go with 0.
More hats to you. A New Heatonism writes, in the novel and ever-expanding field of Andrew Heaton malapropisms, I'd like to submit Occam's Laser from last week's episode into the lexicon. Occam's Laser, defined as choosing the simplest possible explanation of a set of phenomenon and then firing a laser at it.
I love it. I love it. I'm going to start using that. Occam's Laser.
Well, you did. You invented it.
You did.
Oh, I did?
Yes.
I'm a fucking genius.
No, you are on a roll. In fact, I'm pissed off that you haven't done it yet this episode, but back-to-back episodes, you had More Hats to You and Occam's Laser, and I'm so fucking jealous that brilliance just falls out of your dumb mouth.
It More Hats to
does,
Me.
And it
More Hats to You.
There's at least 3 times in every episode that you say something where I just go, well, I don't know what that word is. And I just say nothing because I feel dumb.
And it could be brilliant, but it could be that I'm literally just making noises up that sound like a thing. Sometimes I don't know.
I don't know
if this is real or not, but on the Dana Carvey, David Spade podcast, they always talk about Dennis Miller because they're both friends with Dennis Miller. And Spade says that once every special, he would do a reference that didn't mean anything just to fuck with the people that would tell him that they got all of his references. And just to see whether or not people would laugh, that he would throw in one bullshit reference.
I love it.
Nice.
We're Not Wrong is a production of Dog and Pony Show Audio. Our editor's usually Will Saddleberg, but I think he's on vacation, so I'm going to edit this week. On this week's PX3, we have... Mike Pence, Bidenomics, and I am doing my debate prep, so I am watching old debates from the people that will likely be on stage at the end of this month for the Republican primary, and this week it is Asa Hutchinson from Arkansas and Ron DeSantis from Florida. Check that out. Politics, politics, politics.
When's that debate again?
That is August 23rd on Fox News. And by the way, the next one is going to be on Fox Business. Well, because nobody else wants to pick them up. And also nobody knows whether or not they're even going to exist. The entire field might collapse after the first one. So who knows? Jen, what's up on the dish?
So this weekend, I have my episode about the censure of Adam Schiff coming out. And I just listened to it. It's actually a more fun episode than you would think it is. I'm definitely salty in it. But we look at Adam Schiff, what the Republicans accuse him of. We look at, did he do it? Just the whole saga, because now his name is one of the dirty 25 that has been censured. It's going to go down in history. So we're going to see, was it deserved? What is the censure? Just kind of look at the whole debacle.
The whole bag of Schiff.
Yeah. I like that.
Look at that. Huh? Heaton, what's up on the ORF?
I am always looking for ways to look at politics without having to resort to the left-right spectrum. I think for reasons we've discussed on the program previously, the left-right spectrum is counterproductive and generally false. And so this week, I am bringing on Steve Fuller to talk about his paradigm upwingers and downwingers. It's a very different way of looking at politics. It's a different way of organizing people according to how they view risk and how they view the sanctity of human nature. And it has really weird bedfellows. So like George W. Bush and like the Pope would be downwingers, whereas like libertarians, but also eugenicists would be upwingers. It's an interesting way of looking at the world. That's on The Political Orphanage.
Well, we hope you all enjoy that. But more specifically, you enjoy us. Because we want you to go to patreon.com/we're not wrong. If you do that and you get on our Patreon, not only are you helping us march toward 1,000, but you also get a bonus episode that we're going to record right now because we're done with this one. For Andrew Heaton and Jen Briney, I'm Justin Robert Young. We're not wrong.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.